Catholic Answers Live. Having fun on a Friday doing weird questions with Jimmy Akin. Your weird questions come to us all different ways, and we get them collected up here, and Jimmy answers them, so you don't have to call today. All the questions are here. Jimmy is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. He's the proprietor, as I said, last hour of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Of course, also the author of all kinds of things, including The Bible Was a Catholic Book and A Daily Defense, 365 days plus one to becoming a better apologist. Jimmy, thanks for coming back with us again.
My pleasure.
We time traveled at a rate of 1 second per second to get here from last hour.
Yeah.
And we start with a time travel question, as a matter of fact. Jonathan asks, does time travel exist?
Well, in a basic form, the answer is clearly yes. As we've discussed previously, we all travel into the future at a rate of 1 second per second in our local frame of reference. And it's possible to vary the rate of travel by things like acceleration. Because as you go faster, time moves slower in your frame of reference. So when you decelerate again, more time will have passed, say, on Earth while you were out gallivanting in space, going at an appreciable fraction of the speed of light. Time slows down under the influence of gravity, and so the deeper a gravity well you're in and the stronger the gravity is, the slower time will move for you. And these are things that, as we've discussed, have been verified using airplanes. You can put atomic clocks on airplanes and do an enactment of Einstein's twin paradox, where one clock has had fractionally less time pass for it than another clock left in a base frame of reference. So you can definitely time travel into the future and travel into the future at different rates. The question, the big one, is can you time travel into the past? Now, presently, we don't have any way of physically accomplishing that. The ways that have been, physicists have devoted a lot of thought to it, and they've thought of ways we could do it. But so far, all of the ways that we could do it either involve technology that we don't have, or a shape, kind of a structure to the universe that we don't have. But they're actually working on it. They sometimes will disguise what they're really talking about in their papers, because if you say you want to do a paper on time travel, the funding agencies are going to laugh at you.
Yeah.
So instead of saying, I want to research time travel, they will say, I want to research closed time-like curves. But there is research being done on this. And as of now, there doesn't seem to be anything that would prevent it in principle. There is no law of nature that we're aware of that would prevent travel into the past. And this is something that's been known for quite a while. After Einstein released his general theory of relativity, you know, people started playing with the mathematics of that. And Kurt Gödel, who was like the most important mathematician of the 20th century and a friend of Einstein, quickly realized, hey, here's a way you could go, you could time travel into the past using your relativity, Herr Einstein, which kind of shocked Einstein. But Kurt Gödel had found a model for how the universe could be structured that would allow this. And so is it possible to time travel into the past? Well, we don't know. What we can say is we don't know of any law that would prevent it. And maybe one day we'll find a way to make it practical.
Jonathan, thank you very, very much for visiting us from the future with that question. Jate asks this, Jimmy. Granting that I time travel, another time travel question. Here we go. Granting that I time travel back to the past to Jesus's crucifixion. I take videos of Jesus to prove he exists, and I join Mary and John in approaching him. Is there a possibility that I will be recorded in the Bible? And will the videos and photos I have taken be erased if I come back from the past?
There is no known physical reason that would cause a a photo or video to be erased upon returning to the present. If that were to happen, maybe there's some radiation that would be released that as you come back that would blank it out. But assuming that doesn't happen, it would require an act of God. It would require a miracle in order to interfere with the images you recorded. So unless God chooses to do a miracle and blank them, they would still be there. And in terms of would you be recorded in the Bible or might you be recorded in the Bible, the answer is going to depend on the theory of travel into the past that one has. Now, in our previous answer, I mentioned that we don't know of anything that would prevent us from traveling into the past. So it may be possible. But we also don't know what happens when you get to the past. Can you change it or not? And there are two prominent theories that would address that question. One theory says that the past is immutable, so you could not change it. And if that's the case, then when you go back and take footage of Jesus on the cross and come back to the present, you will not be mentioned in the Bible because the Bible has already been written. And if the past is immutable, then you fit into the past, but you can't change it. And thus you can't change what's in the Bible. On the other hand, there's an alternative, which is what we see explored in a kind of comedic, not very scientifically accurate way in the Back to the Future series, where if you travel into the past and you change something, it creates a branching timeline where things are different. And so if you go back into the past and you take footage of Jesus on the cross and you go towards the cross with Mary and the beloved disciple, hypothetically, in this new timeline, the beloved disciple might choose to record your presence. If you impressed him enough, he might record your presence in the version of the Gospel of John that he writes. Now, you still wouldn't be in our version of the Gospel of John in our timeline because you weren't. But you might be able to be recorded in a different version of the Gospel of John that's written in a different timeline.
All right. I think that brings us right to the break. So we'll take the break and we'll come back with more weird questions for Jimmy Akin. We got a whole bunch more weird questions right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
He was a doctor of the church and one of the greatest defenders of Christ's divinity.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Athanasius of Alexandria fought against the Arian heresy that questioned the divinity of Christ. He once condemned the Arians as opposers of Christ who had dug a pit of ungodliness. It was said of him, Athanasius contra mundum, Athanasius against the world, but for Christ. He died in 373.
To find out more about the Doctors of the Church, visit EWTN.com and click on Catholicism.
Welcome back. Having some fun with Jimmy Akin on this Friday afternoon here at Catholic Answers. Taking weird questions and getting Jimmy's answers to them. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin today, and this one comes from Michelle. Did Adam and Eve have belly buttons?
Okay, so this is an interesting question. Now, we'd have to decide how did Adam and Eve come to exist. The way it's presented in the book of Genesis, Adam was made from the dust of the ground and then like a statue. And so, and then God breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and he became a living being. So this is kind of like a Hebrew version of the Galatea myth from Greek mythology, where you have this statue that gets made. It's also the basis of Pygmalion. And where you have this statue person made first, and then it's animated. And then Eve gets made from Adam's side. Apparently, God, you know, he puts Adam into a deep sleep. He removes one of the ribs, and then he uses the ribs to fashion another body and either animates it or it's already alive. So that's the way it's presented. But the church has acknowledged that the early chapters of Genesis teach us truth using a lot of symbols. And you have these days pontiffs like John Paul II accepting human evolution. Pius XII back in 1950 said that human evolution, he wasn't concerned at all about non-human evolution. It was only human evolution he talked about. And he said it can be accepted, you know, as a theory. And then by the 1990s, more scientific evidence had accumulated, and John Paul II endorsed it. So on the theory that our first parents would have evolved, they would have had belly buttons because they would have been born in a normal way. If they didn't have a normal birth, if they had been made as a dirt statue and a meat statue and then been animated, or the second one was already animated, then they might or might not have belly buttons. And so it would depend on whether God made them with belly buttons. So let's think for a moment about what belly buttons are. For a long time, I thought belly buttons were genetic, that there's something we're just programmed by our genes to have. And that made it easy to say, well, Adam and Eve were human, so they would have had a human genetic code, so they would have had belly buttons. But it appears, I've done further research, and it appears they're not genetic. So, for example, it is not genetic whether you have an innie belly button or an outie belly button. That appears to be determined by life circumstance rather than by genetics, at least primarily. So what actually are they? Well, sometimes people think that they are where your umbilical cord gets cut, and they're like a scar that's left over from where the umbilical cord gets cut after you're born. But that's not the case. Normally, your umbilical cord is cut at least several inches, or at least over an inch from your stomach, and your belly button is on your stomach. So they're not that. What are they? Well, you think about the function of the umbilical cord, and what it does is it brings nutrients through the bloodstream into you as an unborn child, and it also brings oxygen in, and it also takes carbon dioxide out, and it allows that exchange of nutrients and gases to reach an organ known as the placenta, which is at the outside of the amniotic sac, and it's attached to your mom. Now, originally, and this is going back about 300-400 million years, the placenta was originally used just for gas exchange. It was not used for nutrients. But there was a need for animals, and this included, some in eggs as well as in living mothers, to exchange that oxygen for carbon dioxide, to do that swap. And that appears to be what the umbilical cord and the placenta originally developed for. And in eggs, in addition to having a connection with the surface of the egg to allow gas exchange, there was also a yolk sac that had all the nutrients that the baby in the egg would need to draw on during gestation. But when animals started to give live birth And this has happened in more than just mammals. There are, like, you know, sharks and stuff. A lot of sharks give live birth. So do some lizards. When live birth began to develop, that egg sac or the yolk sac was no longer needed because you could draw nutrients from the mother's body. So you didn't need to store up all the nutrients that the baby would need in a yolk sac at the time you laid the egg. And so now that mothers started having their eggs inside of them, the shell would weaken, and it eventually became the amniotic sac. And the placenta took on additional functions. In addition to being able to do gas exchange, it also could draw nutrients from the mother's body to help the unborn baby grow. And so that's essentially the function. If you think about the placenta and the amniotic sac and the umbilical cord, they are essentially organs that we have at one stage of our development. Just like baby frogs or tadpoles have tails. And as they mature into adult frogs, the tails fall off and they grow legs. Well, for humans, umbilical cords and amniotic sacs and placentas are our temporary organs that fall off of us at birth. Now, the umbilical cord doesn't entirely fall off, so it has to be cut. And it's typically cut more than an inch away from the baby's stomach. But within a few weeks, the umbilical cord will naturally die and fall off. And the belly button forms from as the scar that's left from where the umbilical cord remnant falls off. So if Adam and Eve, our first parents, were born in a natural way via, you know, live birth, they would have had umbilical cords. They would have therefore had belly buttons. On the other hand, if you read Genesis as requiring a dirt statue, meat statue view, then they might or might not have belly buttons. It would depend on whether God chose to put belly buttons on their stomachs.
Because there would be no event that created it. It would have to just be.
No natural formation of it. Yeah. It wouldn't be a natural scar. Yeah.
Michelle, thank you for that question. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin today on Catholic Answers Live. This one comes from John. John asks, where are all the cryptid sightings coming from, especially in national parks?
Okay, so cryptids, for people who may not be familiar, are creatures, especially animals, that are not known to exist by mainstream science. The word cryptid comes from the Greek word kryptos, which means hidden. So in effect, these are animals that are hidden from modern science, or from mainstream science. He says, where are all the cryptid sightings coming from? But then he names national parks, and so I assume by where he means what's the reason or what causes them, because he's just named location. Well, national parks.
Right.
So I assume by where are they coming from, he means what causes them. And there are a number of possibilities. One of them is hoaxing. People do commit hoaxes, and you always have to consider the hoax possibility. I recently did a two-part look at the Loch Ness Monster on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, and I talked about some of the early sightings from the 1930s of the Loch Ness Monster, and I concluded some of them were hoaxes.
Yeah.
Some of them were not, but some of them were hoaxes. Also, if you're out in a national park and it's dark and you're camping and it can be kind of spooky and mysterious and your imagination can get going. And so I think some of them are caused by people's imaginations. Also, people sometimes when they go out into national parks and are camping and they're away from law enforcement, they may decide to use some interesting chemicals for recreational purposes. Some of them grow naturally in national parks. Some they bring with them. but they sometimes use recreational chemicals that can affect sensory perception and cause hallucinations. And so I think some of the reports, especially some of the more bizarre ones, may come from that. Also, people can hallucinate for other reasons. I think that most of them, though, or at least a large number of them, are misidentification. And that's something else I covered in the Loch Ness Monster episodes. I think a lot of the Loch Ness Monster sightings are people are seeing something, but they're misidentifying it. In the case of Loch Ness, because there's a big lake there, you could see a water trail caused by a floating log. And the log might be shaped like a head of a plesiosaur, and you think, oh, that's a plesiosaur, but really it's a floating log. Also, there are various animals like deer and seals that swim in Loch Ness that at a distance people could think, oh, that's the Loch Ness Monster. I'm about to record an episode for Mysterious World on a creature from Australia known as the thylacine. It's also known as the Tasmanian tiger or the Tasmanian wolf, because it's Tasmanian tiger because it's got stripes on its hindquarter, and Tasmanian wolf because it looks like a dog. But the thylacine we know existed up to the 1930s. And there are claims that it still exists in the wild right now. So right now it's a cryptid. But a number of the sightings where people like take video and think, oh, I've got a thylacine on video. Well, actually not, because there is another animal that looks kind of like a thylacine in Australia, and that's the fox. And one of the distinguishing features that between foxes and thylacines is foxes have a really bushy tail, whereas thylacines don't. It's a long tail and it's straight, but it is not bushy. But there is also another creature in Australia, which is a kind of mite, M-I-T-E. And mites, when they get on foxes, cause a condition called mange. And mange causes hairs to fall out. And so what a lot of people have actually seen in videos are not thylacines, but foxes with mange that cause the hairs on their tail to fall out so they don't look bushy anymore. And so they're actually seeing, oh, it's a fox and a bunch of mites, but it looks like a thylacine on distant video. Also, this was recently in the news here in America, there's been a notable correlation between where black bears live and where Bigfoot is sighted. And, you know, people tend to see Bigfoot in the same areas where black bears live, and they tend not to see Bigfoot, for the most part, in areas where there are no black bears. And so it's been proposed that a lot of Bigfoot sightings are actually black bear sightings that have been misidentified, because black bears can walk on their hind legs. They can stand up. They can look around. And so if you see a big, tall, hairy thing that's kind of, you know, bipedal standing there, it may be a black bear. And black bears especially will walk on their hind legs when they have damage to their front paws, because it would hurt to walk on the front paws, so they would just stand up and walk on their hind legs, and it can look like a hairy humanoid. So I think misidentification is where a lot of cryptid sightings come from. But then there could also be genuine cryptids that people are sighting. Most animals on Earth that's been calculated have not yet been discovered by mainstream science. And so now most of them are also tiny. So if you want to say there's a cryptid insect or a cryptid microbe, yeah, okay, there's tons of them. Having a big one that hasn't been discovered is much less likely, but there could be some. And I think thylacines actually are a real possibility. There may still be some thylacines out there. But that would be kind of my overall sketch of the likely causes for different cryptid sightings.
John, thank you very much for that question. While you were talking, Jimmy, I was thinking about, I saw in the news that there's a company that's going to bring the dodo bird back, or they're going to try to bring the dodo bird back.
And the woolly mammoth and the thylacine.
I thought, okay, that's where the connection was. Yeah. I'm glad they're going to do all that, but I mostly just want to see a woolly mammoth. I would really like to see a woolly mammoth.
I want to play with a woolly mammoth.
What?
I assume they have personalities like elephants. Elephants are playful.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I guess maybe. Yeah, that makes sense. But I do kind of imagine the smell will be something really impressive from a woolly mammoth. I mean, all that hair on this big giant animal, it just seems like that
it
would...
May have some odor issues.
Yeah, might have some odor issues. All right. Well, Jimmy Akin's our guest, and it's Weird Questions for Jimmy Akin. And we got one coming up about the city of Pompeii. And we've got, we got a Highlander question coming up, a great baptism question, a whole bunch of weird questions coming up. So hang on, and we'll get right back after this to Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity. In the early church was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
As Catholic apologetics have gotten stronger, Protestant responses have gotten stronger as well. And now they have their own answers to rebut the standard Catholic proofs. Don't fret, we've got you covered. In his new book, Meeting the Protestant Response, apologist Carlo Broussard gives well-reasoned biblical answers to Protestant comebacks. Order your copy of Meeting the Protestant Response today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
As a child, the great theologian Thomas Aquinas asked, "What is God?" Best-selling author Kevin Vost's new book follows the mature thought of Aquinas in answering that question. In clear and approachable fashion, What is God examines God's attributes and considers questions about him that have vexed mankind for centuries. Order your copy of What is God today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Monday on More to Life, rest for the weary.
Is burnout getting the best of you? We'll help you get re-energized.
That's Monday on More to Life. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
A little bit of weird music, because it's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin this hour on Catholic Answers Live. We've got them all in with lots of, well, we don't have all the Earth's weird questions, but we got all the ones we're going to use today in, and there are some very good weird ones. And here's one that I'm very interested in, Jimmy. I've been looking forward to you getting this one. It's from Anthony. Anthony says, archaeologists have discovered that there was a small Christian community in the city of Pompeii before the Vesuvius eruption. What if, by some miracle, a scroll somehow survived in the city with the text of something that claimed to be a letter of Paul to the Pompeians? It follows the format of the universally accepted Pauline epistles. It doesn't contradict anything Paul wrote previously, and it ultimately seems to be genuinely from Paul. How do you think the church would respond to this situation?
And he's got a parenthetical comment.
I didn't know that was from him. All right. He says this is a very unlikely hypothetical question, as the temperatures in Pompeii would have likely vaporized any paper.
Well, I don't know that they would have vaporized it. They likely would have destroyed it, or at least blackened it. However, even if something's blackened by heat, that doesn't mean it's unreadable. We've got enough technology now that we're able to look at severely damaged paper frequently and be able to make out what was written on it, because the ink has a different chemical composition than the background of the paper, you know, and with chemical means and also with various means that allow us to detect the chemical, it's often possible to read what was written on a paper, even if the paper is visibly illegible. The odds of recovering something might be a little greater than you might think. I should say that it's not just Pompeii where this has been proposed. Pompeii is the famous town that was destroyed by the eruption of Mount Vesuvius in AD 79, but it wasn't the only town. There were several others around, and another one is known as Herculaneum. And there is some evidence of Christian activity both in Pompeii and in Herculaneum. What archaeologists have found is a series of crosses. These are like very simple crosses, like, you know, the letter X turned, you know, 17 and a half degrees. And so they don't have a corpus on them. If they had a corpus, it would be blindingly obvious this is Christian. But the crosses of Pompeii and Herculaneum have been carved into buildings and into streets, and it looks like they may have performed a function, and that function may have been guiding visiting Christians to the local Christian community. So let's say you're a Christian traveler and you're going to Pompeii. Oh, here's this little string of crosses on the sidewalk leading me towards this bakery. I wonder if there are any Christians in that bakery. And so it's possible that that's what they are. This is not considered certain in archaeology that this is indication of Christian activity, but it's quite possible that it was. I mean, we know Christianity had been in this area so this is around AD 80. We know Christianity was in Rome by the AD 40s. During the reign of Claudius. And so it had already been in this general area for 40 years. And I don't see anything implausible about Christians being in these towns. So what would happen if we found a letter from St. Paul that appeared to be authentic to the Pompeians or the Herculaneans? How would the church react? Well, I think that it would depend in part on what the letter says. Just because something is written by St. Paul doesn't mean it's divinely inspired. In fact, we probably only have a very small number of the letters and other things that Paul would have written in his life. We can tell he's a good author. I mean, you read Romans, and it's incredibly long for an ancient letter. I mean, dozens of times the length of a normal letter. A normal letter is less than 100 words in the ancient world. And this is just monstrous by comparison. And it's very intricately structured, and it's very complex. And consequently, this isn't how Paul began as a writer. You aren't able to undertake big projects until you've done little ones. And so, writers begin, they don't begin by writing a huge nonfiction book, not if they're going to get it published. They start by writing little things like articles, and they build the literary muscle they need to get up to the let's write a big, huge book stage. And the same thing would have happened to Paul. So undoubtedly, he wrote lots of stuff that we don't have. It appears, in fact, that the reason we have the letters that he chose, that we do have in the New Testament, is because he chose to publish them. In the ancient world, literary authors would publish collections of letters. The most famous is that of Cicero. Cicero was famous for his letters, and what would happen is literary authors would keep, they wouldn't just write a letter and send it. They would keep a copy for their archives, and then they would sometimes, like Cicero would, they'd go through their archives and select letters to publish that they wanted to share with others. And they would have to decide at that point, which letters do I include and how do I organize them? You know, do I organize them by the person I sent them to? Do I organize them by when I wrote them? Do I organize them by how long they are? And then after, then time would go by, the author would write more letters and he might die. And if he died, his literary executors might go back through his archives and say, you know, he published that initial collection and it had some great stuff in it, but he wrote some other stuff that hasn't been published yet. So let's add that to a new edition of the collection and we'll organize it the same way. So like if he put things in chronological order in his first collection, we'll just continue that pattern and put them in chronological order too. Well, Paul's letters are not organized in chronological fashion. They're organized in length. So the longest letter, Romans, which is not the first letter he wrote, comes first, and they get progressively shorter after that. And they're also, you have the letters to churches first, and then the letters of individuals. And they also go in reverse order of length, with 1 Timothy being the longest and Philemon being the shortest. So that's the pattern that's used in Paul's letter collections. And it, we can even figure out when the first letter collection was likely released. It was likely released after Galatians. And it consists, it's in German scholarship, it's called the Hauptbrief, but it looks like the Hauptbrief, which consists of Romans, 1st and 2nd Corinthians, and Galatians, which all share common themes, was Paul's original letter collection. And we can tell that because when we get to the next letter after Galatians, which happens to be Ephesians, there's an interruption in the pattern. We've been going from large to small, and that pattern continues after Galatians, but Ephesians is a bump. Ephesians is slightly longer than Galatians. Mm-hmm. So it looks like these four letters were originally released as a collection during the lifetime of St. Paul by St. Paul himself, because that was what normally happened, was the author chose the letters for the initial collection. It looks like the first four were picked by St. Paul for release, and then the later ones were either done by Paul or more likely his literary executors, like maybe Luke and Timothy. Okay, so if we find a letter to the, but he undoubtedly wrote lots of stuff that he didn't choose and that wouldn't be considered divinely inspired. If Paul writes a shopping list, it's not divinely inspired. And the same thing could be true of a letter. So if we got Paul's letter to the Pompeians and he endorses something in it that is contrary to the faith or is really sketchy, well, then that would clearly not be that would not be divinely inspired. And we might go, oh, we never knew Paul thought this, but it's not really compatible with our understanding of things, either of the faith or of something else, so we might not regard it as divinely inspired. We'd also have a collection issue. If we should regard this as a divinely inspired thing, why didn't Paul or his literary executors choose to publish it? You know, the fact that he didn't publish it suggests it's not meant to be in public binding circulation on Christians. Having said that, I think that it's quite that people would give whatever new letter of Paul we found a lot of consideration, especially if it looks authentic. I think that there could even grow up, as long as it doesn't contain anything bizarre, I think that a devotion could grow up around it. And I can't rule out that in, you know, 2,000 years, that devotion might grow to the point of recognizing it as canonical, but I think that would be very unlikely, especially it would not happen for ages and ages if it ever happened at all.
Anthony, thank you for that very fine question. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's Weird Questions for Jimmy Akin this hour. Got to take this last break and then back with more questions for Jimmy right after this.
There's only one. Catholic Answers Live.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
This is Conversations with Consequences, where we delve deeper into issues affecting our church, our country, and our core, the family.
As Catholics, we need to be informed, aware, and able to talk through some of the tough topics that we're facing in our culture and in our world. Conversations with Consequences gives us the tools to do so.
It's not enough to pray. We have to be a light for the world.
Conversations with Consequences, tomorrow at 5 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World dropped this morning, and you can check it out at mysterious.fm. You can be a subscriber there and a supporter and all that. And each week, whatever you do, each week you're going to get a new episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Today's episode, it just left my brain, Jimmy. I'm sorry.
The Versailles time slip.
Oh, yeah. That's right. I really like this one, too, the Versailles time slip. I'm going to listen to that on the way home. That thing that I just did is, you mentioned it earlier, some kind of amnesia, cryptamnesia, I think.
Well, so cryptamnesia is where you remember something, but you don't remember when you learned it. You don't remember the origin. What you had is just normal amnesia, not remembering.
Frequently called a senior moment. Brett asks this question. What are the top three, I say. No, that's not from Brett. What are the top three, or any other arbitrary number, lost books you would love to have? Tell us about them and tell us why you would love to have them. I'd like to read the Gospel of the Hebrews, for example, in its entirety, instead of the fragments left behind in writings by the early church fathers.
Yeah, so the Gospel of Hebrews, which was an early Christian Jewish gospel, would be fascinating to have in its entirety. We do have these tantalizing glimpses. It appears that it was similar to Matthew, but it has some notable differences based on the fragments that have survived, and it would be great to have that one. Since you mentioned biblical books, or books related to the Bible, that's principally what I'm going to name. There are a number of books that are mentioned in the Old Testament that are not in the Old Testament and have been lost. One of them is known as the Books of the Wars of the Lord. And we don't really know what we know. Obviously, this talked about wars that were fought in God's name, but we don't know much more than that. I would love to see what's in that. There's another book known as the Book of Yashar, also called the Book of Jasher or the Book of the Upright, that appears to have been a work of epic poetry about various events early in Israel's history. And so I would love to have a copy of the Book of Yashar and see what that has to say. So the Book of the Wars of the Lord, that might be history. The Book of Yashar, it might be another poetic book. And then there's, and it may be more than one, but there may be several books, but there's at least one by an individual named Iddo the Seer. Iddo the Seer was a prophet in ancient Israel. He had visions. And like Isaiah and Ezekiel and Jeremiah, he was a literary prophet. He wrote about them. And his writings are mentioned in other books of Scripture. They'll say, for more on this, go see the visions of Iddo the Seer. And it's like, okay, I'd love to. Thank you for the recommendation. I'd love to have additional literary prophecy from ancient Israel that's not in our current Bible. So I would love to see that. When it comes to the New Testament, there are also several things that I would like to see. Now, one thing I'd like to see is the letter to the Laodiceans, because we know there was a letter to the Laodiceans. Paul mentions it. However, it's often thought that that may just be the letter to the Ephesians under another name. So I'm not going to waste a wish on that.
Okay.
but I would like to read Zeroth Corinthians, because we know that there was a Zeroth Corinthians. Now, most people are familiar with 1 Corinthians and 2 Corinthians, but in 1 Corinthians, St. Paul mentions a previous letter that he wrote to them. And this is, again, part of why I say he wrote a bunch of stuff we don't even have. I would love to know what's in that earlier letter that's before 1 Corinthians. We could call it, you know, since 0 comes before 1 and 2, we can call it Zeroth Corinthians. There's also an intermediate letter between Zeroth Corinthians and 1 Corinthians. And this letter was not written by Paul. It was written by the Corinthians. And they sent it to him, and they asked about a number of different things. Well, we can tell that because he'll say a few times, as you wrote or as you asked, and we can get a kind of an outline of what was in this. We could call it pre-Corinthians, since it came before 1 Corinthians. Well, we can kind of get an outline for what was in pre-Corinthians, but it's not the same as being able to read it for yourself. And being able to see exactly what they asked could clarify some of the more difficult to understand things that Paul says in 1 Corinthians. So I would love to see not only Zeroth Corinthians, but pre-Corinthians. And there's another letter that we know about in the Corinthian cycle of literature, which came between 1st and 2nd Corinthians. Paul mentions it in 2nd Corinthians. He indicates that he wrote them a really tough letter that he later chose not to include in the collection. He says he wrote it with tears. And so this is sometimes called the sorrowful letter. And I'd love to see what he said in the sorrowful letter. It was probably really intense, because some people have noticed as you're reading 2 Corinthians, you get towards the end of it, you get up to about chapter 10, and he's Mr. Lovey-Dovey. He's like, he's so happy about the Corinthians and we've reconciled and blah, blah, blah. And I'm going to visit y'all and it's going to be great. And then in the last three chapters of 2 Corinthians, he has a meltdown. And Paul just melts down and his mood changes completely. And some people have thought, oh, maybe this is a fragment of the sorrowful letter
that they just got tagged on there.
But I don't think so. I think what happened, because the way you wrote letters back then is you'd dictate what you wanted to say to a scribe. He'd go off and prepare a copy to send with good penmanship and everything like that. He'd bring it back to you, and then you would add a postscript. And the postscript served as an authentication. It's like, yes, this is me. This is my writing. You can see, so that it's not a forgery. And then you would also, in the postscript, update anything that happened that you wanted your audience to know about since you sent the scribe to make the good copy of the letter. And so it looks like what happened to me, Paul has this great reconciliation letter going, he sends the scribe off, and then he gets news that totally honks him off. And so when the scribe comes back with the properly, nicely prepared letter, Paul is enraged and writes a 3-chapter postscript.
And you don't want to honk off Paul.
Yeah, and so I think that's what happened, and thus I think the sorrowful letter was something else, and it was probably at least as intense as the end of 2 Corinthians, and maybe more intense. So I would like to read the Sorrowful Letter. Finally, I would like the 5-volume collection, Exposition of the Logia of the Lord, by the 1st and 2nd century author Papias, who interviewed eyewitnesses of the Lord's ministry. And it appears from, this is debatable, but from what I can tell, it looks like his 5-volume set is an early commentary on the Gospels. And I would love to have that. That is, that would tell us so much about first century Christianity, even if it's not all 100% reliable, which it wouldn't be, it would still shed enormous light on this period, including the ministry of the Lord. So I would love to have that.
What a great question, Brett. Thank you very, very much for that. Jimmy, do you have hope of ever seeing these?
I do. There are new books that have been lost that are being discovered all the times in libraries. And as we mentioned, there are new technologies to read works that have been damaged. So between the discovery, the rediscovery of things, and the, in fact, there are a lot that have been, we know exist or have that exist in libraries. They just haven't been cataloged. And between that and the new technologies, or translated, between that and the new technologies, you know, there's hope of finding some of these things, or at least fragments of them.
Again, thank you very, very much, Brett, for that question. This next question comes from John. Does the Highlander have a soul since he's immortal? Would an immortal being need a soul?
Okay, so The Highlanders in the Highlander series have what you might call type 2 immortality. Type 1 would be you're unkillable. Type 2 is, well, you're killable, but unless you're killed, you're not going to die. And since they kill each other, because there can be only one in the end, they have this type 2 immortality. And presumably they would have souls, because the understanding of the soul, going all the way back to the Greek philosophers, is it's what makes your body alive. And I mean, that's, you know, you have that in Aristotle and in some of the figures before Aristotle. The New Testament agrees with that. James says that the body without the spirit is dead. So your spirit or your soul is what makes your body alive. And Highlanders have living bodies. We know that because before they kill each other, they're not dead. And then after they kill each other, they are dead. So they would have souls animating their bodies like anybody else. They just don't have to die except for their own murderous impulses.
To be immortal and have murderous impulses, not a good combination. Drew asked this question. I think we can get this. Does a baptism apply to a person's entire body? For example, if technology were such that my body died, but one cell remained alive and I was regrown immediately from that cell, is my baptism still valid, or does the regrown body need to be baptized? Similarly, if a baptized person's heart or other organ is transplanted into another non-baptized person, does the organ from the baptized body transmit into its baptismal graces into the new body?
Okay, so the first question is easier to answer than the second. The baptism applies to bodies, and we need to talk about the difference between somatic phenomena. Soma is the Greek word for body, so somatic phenomena is something that happens to your body as an entity, and subsomatic phenomena, like individual cells. So when we die, our heart stops pumping and our body as a whole dies. But individual cells may continue to live for a time after bodily or somatic death. But your soul's already gone. Your soul leaves at somatic death. And so even if there are little bitty cells of yours that are still alive, they're not you. And in the same way, any little cell that's left over after you, if they regrow you from a skin cell, the new you has a new body, or the new entity has a new body, and therefore it will need to be baptized. It will not inherit baptism from a single cell. So Drew's instinct is correct, that baptism is a bodily phenomena that does not apply with continuity to every individual element of the body? And that's a basic answer to that question, but we can talk more about his other question on our next Weird Question show.
All right, Drew, thank you very, very much for that question. Jimmy, that was appropriately weird. Thank you very much for a fun 2 hours on a Friday afternoon.
My pleasure, Cy Kellett.
And that does it for us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.